Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, the Biden agenda. We examine the potential environmental, economic, and political impact of the major climate and health care package passed by the United States Senate. Then, a toxic legacy. Residents living near abandoned uranium mines fight to hold companies and the federal government accountable after experiencing high rates of cancer.
There is a high price that you pay for nuclear energy. They need to understand the front end of this process, and they need to think a little bit harder about the back end of the process.
And a close race. Kenyans prepare to head to the polls to select their next leader after a heated campaign as their country's position in the region grows more important. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. It is a fraction of what President Biden first sought more than a year ago. But after working through the weekend, Democrats are on the cusp of passing an historic spending package. Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins is here to unpack what is in the deal and how party leaders managed to get it done. So, hello, Lisa. Tell us, what are the main elements of this and how did they get it done?
What a dramatic weekend, Judy. That on party lines vote that happened yesterday advanced this massive piece of legislation in the U.S. Senate. The House is expected to vote Friday. So let's look at the big picture. What is in this large piece of legislation? One thing that would change here significantly, it aims to set a corporate minimum tax of 15% for large companies. It would use that money in a few ways. It also would overhaul how Medicare handles prescription drugs. That would save the government money and save some people on Medicare money as well. And there are extensive tax credits throughout this bill to deal with climate change. That's where it spends some of the money raised through those tax increases for some corporations. Now, Judy, I want to talk to people about one other thing in this bill. It would also decrease the deficit. Now, we're waiting for final estimates from the Congressional Budget Office, but here's what we thought the bill looked like as of yesterday, and here's how that deficit reduction works. So, first of all, you take the money brought in by all those tax changes. That's almost $500 billion. Then you add those health care savings from allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. That's about $200 billion. Then you add in that climate spending, so it takes away. That's about $400 billion, also a large amount. In the end, you add it all up, and you get over $200 billion of deficit reduction in addition to everything else in this bill. How did Democrats do it? This bill was dead just a few weeks ago. You and I talked about it. Well, it was a combination of grit and trust and pressure involving two men in particular, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer and West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who said he couldn't get on board. Well, he had secret talks with Senator Schumer. He said, and Schumer said today, it's because of all the pressure after he backed out that came on to Joe Manchin.
Joe Manchin and I had some really heated arguments. And as he said, I turned the dogs on him when he backed off the agreement a week ago, 2 weeks ago Thursday. But we always showed each other respect. And you have to understand, he's in West Virginia, is not New York.
So this was a matter of the relationship there that Manchin had with Schumer. But also, we had some drama yesterday when Senator Kyrsten Sinema had an issue with the bill, even as it was about to face a vote. How'd they get around that? Another important face in all of this, Senator Ron Wyden, the chair of the Finance Committee. His staff managed to find $30 billion to help plug that hole that was a problem yesterday, and his staff had a huge part in writing this bill. A really major achievement for him and Democrats, who many staffers have been working on this for well over a year.
So many twists and turns in this story, Lisa, as you said. So that does give us a sense of the big picture. Also, give us a sense of what this could mean for individual Americans.
So much to talk to about in this, and I think we're going to be talking about it on the show for a few days. But obviously, for those on Medicare, this could save a lot of money in terms of drug prices. It caps what you could spend out of pocket on Medicare on drugs at $2,000. That's significant. But I also want to talk about the electric vehicle credit, because that's something that will affect most families in this country. In this bill, there's an extension of a tax credit to buy an electric vehicle, a new one, $7,500. And you would get that off the price right there at the dealership. Now, this would be $4,000 if you bought a used electric vehicle. It does exclude some of the pricier electric vehicles. The idea is this is not meant to be for luxury vehicles, but for affordable ish electric vehicles for most people. And it also would limit it to who can get this, to individuals making $150,000 or less, families double that. So this is something that most Americans can consider. There is a question, it's so broad, of whether there are enough electric vehicles that qualify right now for all the demand that this may spark initially. But the idea here is that long term, it's creating a huge boost to this industry that Democrats see as vital in terms of fighting climate change.
So, Lisa, we know this is a pretty big bill, 750 pages. You're always very good at finding some things that are generally overlooked. What did you find in here?
I'm going to go through just a few things here. It would actually expand some drilling. That's one thing that Senator Joe Manchin wanted on federal lands. However, it would make that drilling more expensive and offshore as well. It would also expand IRS capabilities to audit Americans, really adding some heft to the Internal Revenue Service. And then finally, coal miners got something out of this. It made permanent funds to help victims who have black lung disease from their time working in coal mines.
And Lisa, just finally, the Democrats did call this the Inflation Reduction Act. How much does it actually reduce inflation?
Remains to be seen, but the Congressional Budget Office said the effects on inflation in the short term are negligible. Judy.
All right, and we will leave it there. Lisa Desjardins, thank you. In the day's other news, the United States is sending another $1 billion in military aid to Ukraine, including rockets and anti-tank weapons. That makes some $9 billion in U.S. assistance to date. Meanwhile, Ukraine is warning that the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, now under Russian control, is in jeopardy. It has been shelled repeatedly in recent days, and there are fears of a radiation leak or worse.
This is the biggest power station in Europe. A nuclear power station in Europe, and if something happens, so there will be huge consequences, not only for Ukraine, probably all Ukraine will be contaminated.
Also today, Russia temporarily halted inspections of its nuclear arsenal under the START arms control treaty with the U.S. It blamed the American sanctions over Ukraine. A ceasefire held today between Israel and Islamic Jihad militants in Gaza, after weekend fighting killed at least 44 Palestinians. Fuel and supply trucks entered Gaza as Israel reopened crossings that in turn allowed Gaza's sole power plant to resume operations. China has announced more military exercises around Taiwan, keeping tensions high in the region. It is retaliation for a Taiwan visit by Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. But in Delaware this morning, President Biden played down the chances of outright conflict.
I'm not worried, but I'm concerned that they're moving as much as they are. But I don't think they're going to do anything more.
Later, the president got a firsthand look at flood damage in eastern Kentucky, including a site where surging water smashed a school bus into a building. It was his first major trip after emerging from COVID isolation. Three white men who murdered Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia in 2020 were sentenced today for federal hate crimes. Father and son, Greg and Travis McMichael, drew life in prison. William Roddy Bryan got 35 years. The judge also ruled that they must serve their time and their life sentences for state murder convictions in state prison. The McMichaels had argued that they would not be safe there. Investigators in New Mexico searched today for a vehicle that could be connected to the killings of four Muslim men. Police say this car, a dark gray or silver Volkswagen, may have been used in all four homicides. The victims were of South Asian descent. The latest was killed on Friday. Wall Street mostly marked time today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 29 points to close at 32,832. The Nasdaq fell 13 points. The S&P 500 lost 5. And two passings of note. Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough died Sunday at the age of 89 in Massachusetts. We'll have a remembrance later in the program. And singer and actress Olivia Newton-John died this morning in Southern California. She had a series of hit songs in the 1970s and 80s, and she starred in the musical Grease. Olivia Newton-John was 73 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, Amy Walter and Annie Linsky weigh in on how the Inflation Reduction Act could affect the midterm elections. Residents in the American Southwest struggle with the health effects of nuclear ore extraction. Kenyans prepare to head to the polls to select their next president after a divisive race, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The passage of the Inflation Reduction Act is a major legislative victory for the Biden administration, and it comes after months of negotiations, as we've heard, on Capitol Hill. Joining me now to discuss it all is Brian Deese, chair of the National Economic Council and the president's top economic advisor. Brian Deese, welcome back to the NewsHour. As we've been saying, this is only a fraction, maybe a fourth, of what the administration originally asked for last year. But at this point, what is this going to mean if it becomes law for the country and for the Biden administration?
Well, thanks for having me. This is a truly historic piece of legislation. For decades in this country, we have been talking about doing something about prescription drug prices. This bill would allow Medicare to negotiate lower prescription drug prices for the first time. For decades, we've been trying to do something to address climate change, and this bill would make the largest single investment in climate change and energy security ever. And it will do both of those things in a way that actually reduces the federal deficit, which is what we need right now economically to try to help reduce inflation as well. So what this is going to mean for American families is lower prescription drug prices, lower health care costs, lower energy bills across time, and the Congress and the president together acting to try to reduce inflation as well.
That's an impressive list. The title of the bill, though, Brian Deese, is the Inflation Reduction Act. The Congressional Budget Office took a look at this, as you know, and what they came up with is they say it's likely to change the inflation rate by less than a tenth of 1% over a few years, and they're saying they're not sure whether the change is up or down. So is it fair, do you think, to call it inflation reduction?
I think it is. Look, economists who have looked at this closely, including former Treasury secretaries from both political parties, have come to the conclusion that this would help on easing price pressures throughout our economy. But let me explain why that's the case. First, it will lower costs for families. So the families who are struggling with high prices will face lower costs. As early as just this fall, 13 million Americans will see their health insurance premiums come down as a result of this bill. And second, by reducing the federal deficit, that is complementary to what the Fed is trying to accomplish and will help reduce prices. And third, and importantly, by increasing the supply of energy in particular in this country, while moving us toward clean energy, we're going to reduce price pressures overall. You know, we had the CEOs of utility companies here, and they said the principal impact of passing these long-term tax credits, for example, for clean energy, is that they pass those directly on to ratepayers, meaning a customer who's getting a utility bill is going to see that benefit on her utility bill. So I think across the board, in practical terms, it means lower costs for consumers. And in economic terms, it's going to mean reduced price pressures across the economy.
I'm asking you about what this is going to mean for ordinary Americans and whether most Americans are going to feel this, because we heard Senator Bernie Sanders say on the floor of the Senate, and I'm quoting him, this bill does nothing to address the greatest financial challenges facing families in this country.
Well, look, we're working across the board to address the financial challenges that families face. And as you and I have talked about before, there are things like gas prices that are front and center for American families. We've made a lot of progress on that front, seeing gas prices down by almost a dollar. But in very practical terms, this piece of legislation will make a big difference for families in areas that are really consequential to their lives. You know, prescription drugs and the costs that bases for families, that's a big deal, particularly for families that face have a member of the family who has a chronic condition. This bill would cap the out-of-pocket costs for Medicare recipients and those with chronic conditions at $2,000. That's a big game-changing deal. For people who have health insurance and are wondering this fall whether they're going to see their premiums jump up in the Affordable Care Act, this bill is going to provide, as I said, 13 million Americans the security to know that they're going to be able to keep those health insurance premiums low. And for people who sit around the kitchen table and think about how to make their monthly bills add up, things like prescription drugs and healthcare premiums and their utility bills and energy costs, those are meaningful in their lives.
Well, you also mentioned clean energy here, but we know that also in this legislation are provisions that are going to provide for more oil and gas exploration in the country. I think people are trying to understand what the balance is here. More fossil fuels, but clean energy. How do you square that?
Well, I think what's most important for people to understand is that this bill puts the United States on a path to meet its climate commitments by the end of this decade. And for the first time in decades, the United States, if this bill is signed into law, will be in a position where we can clearly and credibly say that we will meet our climate commitments. The way it does so is to provide long-term incentives, technology-neutral incentives, to invest in cleaner and lower emissions technologies across the board, from wind and solar to storage, hydrogen, carbon capture. These are the technologies that are going to drive us to a lower emissions economy. And also, they're the technologies that if we develop them, we innovate here in the United States, we can export to the world. That means more jobs, it means more manufacturing capacity here in the United States, but ultimately it means that we can hit our climate commitments as a nation, and then we can hold other nations to account to hit theirs as well.
Two other very quick questions, Brian Deese. You said this is going to reduce the deficit, but the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget looked at this and they said yes, yes, but only by a very small amount, $25 billion over the next 5 years, which is, they said, a drop in the bucket.
Well, look, over the next 10 years, this bill will reduce the deficit by about $300 billion. And just to put that in context, that will come on top of the fact that already this year, the deficit is down $1.7 trillion. So this is deficit reduction that will build on a record of reducing the deficit. And I wouldn't downplay the significance of that, particularly at a moment where our economy is facing the price challenges that we are facing. Demonstrating that we can continue to make progress on deficit reduction is an important part of this bill.
Finally, the last thing I want to ask you is, we know some of the richest Americans, hedge fund executives, private equity executives, virtually untouched by this because of provisions that were taken out. But what are some provisions that were in there originally that the administration, that the president would like to come back to in months to come?
Well, on the tax side, let me start with what's in there. We will now, for the first time, have a minimum tax so that the largest corporations in the country, those with more than $1 billion in income, will have to pay a 15% minimum tax, which is a matter of basic fairness and good tax policy. And we will be able to get that done if this bill is signed into law. Look, there are other provisions that the president feels strongly about, particularly making sure that the highest income individuals, the billionaires of this country, are also paying a reasonable amount as well. And we've got a number of proposals on that front. Still have work to do on that. That will be work remaining once we get this bill enacted into law.
All right, we are going to leave it there. Brian Deese, who is a chief economic advisor to the president, thank you.
Thanks.
And as we have reported, the bill passed by the Senate would push billions of dollars toward boosting clean energy projects and combating global warming. William Brangham has more on what is being described as potentially America's first major climate law.
That's right, Judy. If this passes the House and the president signs it into law, it will be by far the biggest investment the federal government has ever made to tackle climate change. According to several estimates, this initiative could produce a 40% reduction in America's carbon emissions by 2030. That's compared to 2005 levels. So for some context, I'm joined by Paul Bledsoe. He's a strategic advisor at the Progressive Policy Institute and president of Bledsoe and Associates. It's a policy firm that specializes in climate change. He's also worked on several international climate change treaties. Paul Bledsoe, great to have you on the program. We just heard Brian Deese, the president's economic advisor, say that this bill, if it becomes law, puts America on a path to meet its climate commitments. Is that true? Is this that substantial?
It comes very close. It will reduce U.S. CO2 emissions by about 40% this decade by 2030, which is a huge amount of progress, and the administration deserves real credit for it. But it is important to note that the U.S. is only 15% of total global emissions. One of the things this bill has to do is begin to lead the American economy, to lead the world in clean energy production, and put pressure and opportunity on nations around the world to clean up their economies and grow their clean energy sectors. For example, China has 30% of global emissions, twice what the U.S. does, and just withdrew from bilateral talks on climate change. So this bill has to not only grow the U.S. clean energy economy, but begin a global transition.
A lot of the pieces within this bill are tax incentives. They're carrots as opposed to sticks to encourage utilities and cities and individuals to move in this direction. Is it your understanding that those incentives are enough to encourage this process to start really moving aggressively?
Thanks, William. It's a really important point. This is not about government spending. This is about providing consumers and businesses incentives to make big investments. We're talking about trillions of dollars over the next decade in a brand new clean energy sector that's going to create millions of new jobs and save consumers thousands of dollars a year. This is going to re-energize much of the American private sector economy. So this is in very much a market approach to getting the private sector making these large investments that will make the United States much stronger in terms of our energy security, our overall economy, and reduction in greenhouse gas emissions.
I want to ask you a political question, because it is striking how virtually the entire GOP was hostile or dismissive to any real substantive action on climate change. And public opinion polling on climate change seems to waffle as to how important it really is to voters. And yet, these very substantial climate provisions have endured for almost a year. How do you account for that?
You know, it's interesting. Formerly, Democrats proposed energy taxes, that is carbon taxes, to deal with the climate problem, and those were politically unpopular. Now, however, Democrats have finally hit on a tremendously popular set of policies: tax cuts for businesses and consumers for clean energy. These are favored by Republicans, Democrats, and independents in all polling. I think the Republicans have made a huge mistake in underestimating how much the business community and average Americans want these new technologies. And I think that if Democrats are smart, they'll run on this pro-business, pro-economic platform of clean energy in the midterms.
Let's say that this goes through. You and others have said this is certainly not the be-all and end-all. It's not like we'll have solved the problem overnight. What are some other steps you would like to see the administration take going forward?
Thank you. It's a great question. One thing that Senator Schumer committed to as part of these negotiations, including with Senator Manchin, was that we would look at permitting reform for U.S. infrastructure. Right now, it's extremely difficult to put up the big power lines we need to move clean energy from the places where we can cheaply generate it to the places where we can use it. We also need more pipelines for natural gas so that we can completely eliminate coal. And we're going to need to export gas so that we can help the rest of the world eliminate coal. There's a lot of other work to be done. Another area is methane emissions. Methane is a super pollutant 80 times more powerful than CO2 and is the key to controlling near-term temperature increases. This bill creates about a $1.5 billion fund to mitigate methane from the oil and gas sector, which is important, but much more needs to be done on these non-CO2 pollutants, which are a key to limiting near-term temperatures and preventing runaway warming in natural systems.
All right, Paul Bledsoe of the Progressive Policy Institute, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much.
And back to you, Judy.
And now to talk about the political stakes of the Democrats' major legislative victory, I am joined by Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Annie Linsky with The Washington Post. Tamara Keith is away.
Hello to both of you. So it's been a big weekend here in Washington. Yes. Congress got something done. They passed the Democrats' victory in the Senate.
That's right.
Amy, what do you make of this? I mean, we're not used to seeing this.
Well, not certainly in recent months. Although, as I said the other week, Democrats have had a pretty good run of things for the course of this summer between guns and the semiconductor bill and now this, which of course has to still make it through the House, but that's still a big success. The question is, it's long-term and short-term political implications, right? And in the short term, what we know historically is even parties that pass major legislation during a midterm year, whether it was Bill Clinton or Barack Obama or Donald Trump or LBJ, they have not been rewarded in a midterm year for big legislative policy victories. Now, 2 years later, at a presidential election, perhaps, but all of those presidents lost seats in the House in their first midterm election. The other real big question for the short term is, are voters gonna feel better about the economy by October, November? You can have people come on and tell you everything about it's called the Inflation Reduction Act and things are getting better and we're not in a recession. But right now people believe we're headed to a recession and the Consumer Confidence Index is about as low as it has been in its history.
And Annie, what about that? I mean, we heard Brian Deese from the White House just a few minutes ago saying, oh, people are going to feel, they're going to see it in their lower prescription drug prices, medical bills. But how much of that is going to be felt?
Well, I think that's right. Amy's right. It won't be felt immediately. But I think I'd hate for one thing to get lost here, which is, you know, this is a very big piece of legislation. I mean, Democrats, I was thinking about this recently, I mean, since the turn of this millennia, have been talking about this talking point of we are going to have Medicare negotiate for prescription drug right. prices. We have heard this talking point from this party for, you know, the last 25 years. And they have finally done it. Yeah. And so I do think that that is something that they can say to their voters, that they got a major piece of their agenda done. I think it's right. A lot of things that they asked for, they did not get done. There's no child tax credit. That's been off the table. But there are things here that Democrats can talk about in the fall. And, you know, talking to some Republicans about this, they are also saying they realize that they will be on defense on the prescription drug piece, but yeah. also, interestingly, the pay for. They are realizing that Democrats really do have a good populist talking point that they are paying for this bill by having the richest companies, you know, in the country, in the world, really, that haven't been paying taxes, the companies that have had zero taxes that they've paid, suddenly having to pay taxes.
That's right. So. You're going to see corporate, minimum corporate tax, again, as we heard Brian Deese talking about. And you're going to hear more conversation about the deficit. Democrats can say we're doing something about the deficit. The question is how much are voters?
Right. How much are voters believing and believing that? And the other important piece, piggybacking on what Annie said about passing legislation they've talked about for years, it's not insignificant what they've done on climate. And for Democratic-leaning voters, climate is a top issue. Even as inflation and abortion, those issues continue to rise and a concern for Democratic voters, especially younger voters, the key elements of the Democratic coalition, they are very concerned about climate. And so they have a story to tell. Is it enough for this election? Don't know, but certainly something for 2024 as well.
Yeah, because so many, there's so much focus, Annie, right now on the midterms, understandably.
Right.
I mean, the Democrats want to hold down their losses in the House, and certainly they want to hold on to the Senate. Speaking of which, we have more August primaries. We've spoken about that before.
Yes.
Coming up, Annie, tomorrow in four states, including Wisconsin, a state that we are watching very closely, a hard fought between the former President Trump, who's been in there endorsing his favorite and other candidates. What are you looking for?
I think the big race that everybody's going to be watching tomorrow night, and you're right, that Wisconsin governor's race, it's the Republican primary. And there, you, as you pointed out, you have a candidate that Trump has backed and a candidate that Pence, that a former Vice President Pence has backed. And I think what's interesting in this particular one is the two candidates honestly are not that different. I mean, you're not looking at a scenario where you have sort of a truly more sort of moderate candidate versus a more extreme candidate. These are candidates that have policy positions that are quite similar. They have both sort of flirted with, you know, denying the 2020 election. They have similar views on abortion. It's more of a stylistic difference. And so I think what you're really going to see is, yes, this will be a test of how much sway does Trump continue to have over the primary. But whoever wins on you know, whoever wins tomorrow is still going to be somebody who has talked about denying the election and has not really embraced that Biden is president of the United States.
It is sort of funny in Wisconsin to think about. So Scott Walker, the one of his lieutenant governor, who he's endorsed, is one of those candidates in the primary. Scott Walker was the original Tea Party. He was the anti-establishment. Yes. Now his candidate is being derided as part of the Rhino establishment by Donald Trump, as well as the Speaker of the House, Robin Voss, who has been just really, for Democrats, the person who they've fought up against time and time again. And yet Donald Trump has endorsed Voss's primary opponent. Why? Because Voss will not admit that the election was stolen or rigged or believe in the big lie that the president put forward. So it is quite remarkable that in just a very short amount of time, the people who are on the vanguard
of
bringing Republicans into power in that state and taking a sort of no holds barred approach are now seen as the moderates, and they are part of the establishment.
Which sets it up for, in November, Annie,
yes,
a really fascinating contest.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
In Wisconsin and these other states we've been looking at.
Well, I think in Wisconsin in particular, I think the Senate race there will be of particular interest. I mean, there you have Mandela Barnes, a 35-year-old African-American working class roots candidate, who will be taking on Ron Johnson, who's much older, he's very wealthy, he's a much more sort of traditional Republican, and has said a number of very controversial things. And so you'll have a fascinating contest between those two.
That's right.
And you're the one who said, no more August primaries.
Right.
But they keep some interest.
No, there's a lot. There's a lot going on in this. And eventually what we're going to see is many of these candidates that Donald Trump has endorsed, they are right now in some of these Senate races running behind where they should be given the environment. Are they going to be able to catch up before November? And if so, will Trump get the blame for perhaps Democrats keeping hold of the Senate?
Utterly fascinating.
Totally.
All of it.
It's a lot of fun.
Amy Walter, Annie Linsky, thank you both.
You're Thanks. Welcome.
It's great.
For decades, residents of the American Southwest, including many indigenous peoples, have been exposed to elevated levels of radiation from uranium extraction and refining, a toxic legacy of the Cold War's weapons program and nuclear power generation. In partnership with the nonprofit investigative newsroom ProPublica, Stephanie Tsai reports on one community's fight to survive and to hold a company and the federal government accountable.
This is a map that my daughter put together to show the different types of cancer around the subdivision that we lived in.
In Cibola County, in the high, sparsely populated desert of northwest New Mexico, it became known as the death map.
The green is cancer, and then the yellow is cancer deaths.
Skin cancer, breast cancer, thyroid disease. Johnny Head, herself a breast cancer survivor, points to all the families who over the years were hit.
So given how sparsely populated it is, it seems like a lot of cancers.
It does, doesn't it?
She and her family lived in the nearby Murray Acres subdivision for decades.
It was a beautiful little green community. We had lots of alfalfa, pastures, horses, cows. I would have left there earlier, much earlier, had I known the situation.
The situation was that their quaint slice of paradise was less than half a mile from 22 million tons of uranium waste. From World War II through the Cold War, uranium ore was heavily mined across the Four Corners region of Arizona, Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico to produce nuclear weapons and energy. Chemicals were used to extract and mill the uranium, and the waste was put into tailings piles, many of which were unlined and uncapped.
Massive piles of uranium waste like this one in northwest New Mexico have continued to blow and leak contamination into surrounding communities. Infrastructure from three decades of uranium mining has left a toxic legacy throughout the Southwest.
We're 40 years out from the kind of death of American uranium, and we still haven't cleaned this up.
Mark Alalde and a team at ProPublica have been investigating some 50 former uranium mills around the country for the last several months. About half of the mills are yet to be cleaned up and sealed, including this one owned by the Homestake Mining Company, now a subsidiary of Barrick Gold. While operations ended in 1990, the cleanup continues.
There are concerns from downstream communities that the plumes of uranium could eventually migrate to their intake wells and contaminate their drinking water sources too. In one household close to the pile, we found levels of radon about almost twice as high as what the EPA says is an actual level that you need to pretty immediately clean out your house.
A 2014 study conducted by the Environmental Protection Agency found an unacceptable level of excess cancer risk from the mill site. John Boomer and Maggie Billiman are among the several thousand residents living downstream.
I was just thrilled to have all this space. I thought I can put my wood in here, all my art.
An artist, John needed a big space when he bought the land in 2001 and trusted the EPA, which said the site would be cleaned up by 2003.
The site implied to me, or the way I understood it, was that they were on top of the problem and that it would be fixed in short order. I mean, that they had been working on it already 20 years when I bought the property. This was another office.
But he says there were problems with all the fixes. The contamination in groundwater and aquifers spread.
We never get real clear answers. We've asked for health studies, cancer, you know, cluster studies and things like that, and it all seems to just kind of go here and there.
It's depressing.
Maggie Billiman is a member of the Navajo Nation. Not only her house, but much of her native land has borne the brunt of America's toxic waste legacy. More than 500 abandoned uranium mines pockmark the Navajo Nation, nearly all within a mile of a water source. And there are far higher levels of cancer among her people than the general population. Maggie's own father, a Navajo code talker during World War II, died of stomach cancer, she believes due to nuclear testing in neighboring Nevada.
Have you started to see any health impacts?
My swallowing is kind of funny. And we've been coughing a lot in this household. And we don't know what that's coming from. I'm seeing changes, but you know, the doctors are not pinpointing. I always think that, gosh, what about if it's too late?
In previous lawsuits, Homestake Mining Company has denied that its facilities are causing illness, and it is now trying to absolve itself of further responsibility.
Barrick Gold and Homestake are now trying to be done with cleanup, to get exemptions from the government, to change the regulatory standards at the site so they can kind of wash their hands of it, hand it over to the Department of Energy, and have it now be the federal government's problem.
United States regulators can't possibly think that this is okay.
In the meantime, some, including Candace Head Dilla, have agreed to take buyout offers from Homestake.
We trusted the federal government.
we really thought that once they said this was going to be cleaned up, that it would be.
Shandy sold out, I thought. Mom told
me.
She
did sell out.
Candace is Johnny's daughter, the woman we met at the beginning of this story.
He acts gentle as can be today.
She moved to Colorado in 2019. It wasn't an easy decision, leaving both her parents and her dream house in the Murray Acres subdivision behind.
This is my mom, my two grandmas. Yeah. And this is outside on the barn, and the tailings pile's right over here.
The tailings pile was never far from mine. And in 2006, she found her own place on the map of disease.
My thyroid is completely removed. I have no thyroid. What it means is that if I ever don't have that medication, it's just a few months before, until I die.
Mark Alalde says Candace's story is representative of what's broadly happening in this community.
They are moving people. They are tearing down the homes. And in the process, they're having the residents sign non-disparagement agreements and liability waivers saying, essentially, we can't sue you moving forward.
Even if we have cancer down the line.
We can't sue you for anything.
Despite signing the non-disparagement agreement, Candace continues to speak out to prevent a repeat of history. Climate change and the push for more low-carbon energy, as well as sanctions on Russia, an exporter of uranium, have renewed conversations about nuclear power, which Candace says comes at a cost.
There is a high price that you pay for nuclear energy. They need to understand the front end of this process, and they need to think a little bit harder about the back end of the process.
The war effort and the Cold War, you know, made us rush headlong into an industry without thinking about the consequences down the road. And it tells us that when you try to regulate at the tail end of an industry as opposed to at the outset of its creation, it's really tough to get that right. And it's really expensive to get that right. And it leaves us kind of asking the question of, well, who's going to take charge of this?
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which oversees the cleanup of the Homestake Mill, said in a statement that the site is hydrogeologically complex, making target dates for groundwater remediation difficult to estimate with precision. Quote, "We understand and share the concern that remediation is taking so long." Meanwhile, in a letter to ProPublica, Homestake said it's no longer feasible to improve water quality at the site. It said it followed government requirements and standard practices of the time, and in the final stages of closing the site, the company will place a cover on the tailings pile to reduce radon emissions. But there's still no deadline for when that will happen. It's already taken decades, and for Candace Head Dilla's family, generations of waiting. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
And we would add this, our reporting partners at ProPublica are continuing their investigation, but they need your help. If you have worked with any public agencies, consulting firms, tribes, or companies involved in the uranium industry, you can share your experience by going to ProPublica.org/uranium. Kenyans will go to the polls tomorrow to elect a new president. In a nation with a history of contested and violent elections, this is the first time a member of the politically dominant Kikuyu tribe is not running. And many claim this is Kenya's first election in which class plays a greater role than ethnicity. Correspondent Neha Wadekar and filmmaker Jack Hewson sent us this report.
Political hysteria is at an all-time high here in the heartland of Western Kenya's Luo tribe. Never in Kenya's nearly 60-year democratic history has a Luo taken power. Now, the father of this tribe wants to become the father of the nation. Nicknamed Baba, or Dad in Kiswahili, Raila Odinga has made four unsuccessful attempts at the presidency. His diehard supporters say this is finally his time.
I just came to witness, to be part of history, because this is one of the last rallies that Mr. Raila Odinga is having here in Kisumu, his own backyard. So we are really excited as we wait for the elections on Tuesday.
The Luos of Western Kenya have long felt ignored by Nairobi's political class, in part because of a dynastic rivalry between Odinga and Kenya sitting president Uhuru Kenyatta, whose Kikuyu tribe has dominated Kenyan politics for decades. But a few years ago, the men pulled a 180 and forged a surprising alliance, cooperating in government for the first time.
Uhuru is the outgoing president of the Republic of Kenya. Leave him alone. Let him go and retire in peace.
This newfound friendship with the sitting president gave Odinga the power and backing of the state. But after so much animosity, some say he's being groomed to take over and wonder if Odinga is now obligated to dance to Kenyatta's tune.
It's not unusual that the outgoing president can campaign for somebody else. So what we're doing, is President Kenyatta is doing, is not unique. But I'm not President Kenyatta. Everybody knows that. And I cannot be somebody's project. Most Kenyans know that very well.
Some critics claim that you have been selected so that President Kenyatta and the Kenyatta family can protect their family wealth. Many claim that this wealth has been acquired through corruption and or abuse of power. So would you be willing, sir, to back any potential investigations into the Kenyatta family wealth if you get into office?
You said that we will deal with all the corruption cases, irrespective of how high it is. And therefore, even myself, I'm clearly, I'm not an exception. And nobody else is going to be an exception in this regard.
While Odinga's story is one rooted in dynastic succession and tribal politics, his opponent, Deputy President William Ruto, brings a new dynamic to the race. Ruto's populist message is that anyone can succeed, regardless of ethnicity or class. A one-time roadside vendor turned elite politician, he presents himself as hustler number one. He's running on a bottom-up economics platform that appeals to Kenyans hit hard by inflation.
It's all about the bottom-up. As you can see in his manifesto, he has talking about employment for the youth. The bottom-up, the hustlers fund that is going to give the hustlers, especially the small businesses. He has spoken about lifting us, the cost of living, so we are expecting much from him.
Fearing defeat, both Raila and Ruto have tried to undermine Kenya's electoral commission. Ruto's claim is that President Kenyatta and the deep state are against him, and he's preparing his supporters to expect government interference.
We want to give them a warning ahead of time. We will not allow you this time to pull the railway. We will not allow you this time to organize demonstrations. We will not allow you this time to swear yourselves in. We are going to finish with you in the morning, and we will put you on a wheelbarrow express to come.
Candidates have already cast doubt on the integrity of the electoral process, and it remains to be seen whether they'll challenge the results of the vote in court or even in the streets. With Ruto positioning himself as an outsider in an unfair election, there are worries about violence if he loses and refuses to concede.
For the people in the United States who might be expecting violence in this election, would you like to tell them what you are expecting and what you might tell your supporters if they decide to take to the streets, sir?
Some of us cannot campaign in my competitor's backyard.
Yes, sir.
Because he's a violent man. I went there last year, and all my 9 vehicles were destroyed. That is where violence will be if Raila Odinga loses. The only time Raila believes an election is free and fair is where he has won. And unfortunately, he has won no election.
With each candidate pointing fingers at the other, many fear violence as seen in 2017, when Odinga lost to Kenyatta. During that election, Odinga's supporters took to the streets and dozens were killed and injured in clashes between protesters and security forces. The unrest was prompted by allegations of corruption and incompetence at the Electoral Commission, with Odinga rejecting the final results. Now, the commission is again facing similar allegations in this election. Bena Baluma knows too well how dangerous this could be. After the 2017 election, her two sons, Bernard and Victor, were shot dead by police on their way home from work in one of Nairobi's poorest neighborhoods. A walk through the streets brought us close to the spot where they were killed.
So with this place here, it's where one young man was being shot. This one.
Wow.
This one. Those are bullets.
And one of the men was killed right here?
Yeah. One of the men was killed here.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is you? 5 years on, the memory of finding her son's bodies is still very raw.
Sometimes when I am lonely, I feel very, very bitter. Sometimes when I see young men who are the friends, you know, I feel bitter. Sometimes there are pictures come, but sometimes I feel like they went abroad, they will come one day, one time.
Since her son's deaths, Baluma has become a social justice activist. She has a message for the politicians vying on August 9th.
Let them calm down. Let them calm down. Let them just be peace. Because these are their people whom they are going to rule. So when they kill people, what are they going to rule?
On the eve of the vote, the atmosphere is tense, and it's difficult to see how either candidate or their supporters will accept defeat. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Neha Wadekar in Nairobi, Kenya.
Finally, we remember the great historian and writer David McCullough in his own words. He was best known for his Pulitzer Prize-winning biographies of two often overlooked presidents, John Adams and Harry Truman. And PBS viewers might recognize him as the voice of Ken Burns' acclaimed series, The Civil War. But his interests ranged far and wide, including the arts. In 2011, he spoke to Jeffrey Brown about his book, The Greater Journey, about the influence of French artists and thinkers on Americans traveling to France in the 19th century. In this excerpt, Jeff began by asking McCullough about his love of research and discovery.
What have you learned after all these years of
I guess what
looking
I've,
for
I've never been involved with a project where something didn't turn up. No, never.
Never.
And I never. And you think, oh, that's been gone over again and again. You're not going to find anything. Oh, yes, you do. And you find
but
it surprising places.
But you, have to, know to, you
places.
Have to know how to dig or look.
Well, right? You also have to keep an open mind, because often you find it in a person, somebody who has something to say. When I was working on my Truman book, I interviewed one of his Secret Service guards. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the interview, I thanked him very much, because he really gave me a lot of time, and it was infinitely interesting and valuable. And I thanked him. I said, particularly when I think how many times you must have been asked these questions. He said, Mr. McCullough, I've never been asked these questions. You have to be sure you don't let appearances lead you to wrong conclusions about people and about where things are. I've felt for a very long time that history is more than politics and the military and social issues. Yes, it is politics and the military and social issues, but it's also art and music and architecture and ideas and science and medicine. It's the works. It's human.
I understand that you yourself wanted to be a painter early on and
I still study. Do.
You still do?
I still do. I paint all the time. I love it.
You do?
Yes, I do indeed. And I highly recommend it to everyone. Get out there and paint. It's good for the soul. But I also particularly stress to people who say they want to become writers, young people, to take a course in drawing or painting, because it helps you to learn to see, to look. And that's what writing is often about.
Great advice from David McCullough, who was not only an extraordinary historian and writer, he was just a delightful human being. We mourn his passing. And that's a NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.